Well, good morning. Am I coming through loud and clear enough? Great to be with you, church family. I say church family because when we visit here, it feels incredibly warm and encouraging for us as a family, as the church has been supporting us in missions for 18 years. It's as worthy, God is as worthy of that clap for how he's provided for us as it is that he could use me to do something for his sake. I don't know if you all ever have had such a sense of gratitude that you feel almost on the verge of tears, but in my seat as I was singing and just being with you guys this morning, it might be an emotional morning for me as I speak. Just because I really am that grateful just to see over 18 years what God's done. I mean, literally the thousands of college students that I've been able to share life with, to share the gospel with, to see people's lives completely, radically transformed, to walk with Jesus in a way that they had never expected and that I had never expected. And to be a part of that is just such an incredible joy. And so thank you all as a church and as individuals for the way that you have literally carried us to do this work. And so, I don't want to get too emotional up front, so I'm going to transition quickly to something else. But I want to share with you guys some of what's happening first. I have kind of this impossible task ahead of me this morning because I want to both preach to you from the Word, but I also want to share with you what's happening in our ministry. And I could probably spend 2 or 4 or 8 hours on each of those things alone. So I've taken a message that I've shared with students and I've hopefully compressed it. And then I've also got some things I'd just love to update you about. Clearly there's not enough time for me to do all of what I want to do this morning and what I want to share with you guys, even just at a personal level. But I figured since you've supported me for 18 years, I'd give you your money's worth. So, you know, I'm not one to cut corners. So, all right, so I'm going to have to try to multitask. I haven't used one of these gadgets in a long, long time. I don't know if I can skip. I'm going to skip through all my, I put my pictures at the wrong place. So I was going to change it this morning and I didn't. So let me just give you a preface. There we go. CRU at West Virginia University. CRU is, if you aren't familiar, Campus Crusade for Christ, rebranded. It is an interdenominational Christian organization that aims to win students and faculty on college campuses to Christ, to build them in their faith, and then to launch them into the world to do the very same thing. And so we are a parachurch ministry which comes alongside of the church to hopefully excel in the things of discipleship and evangelism on the college campus. And then from that point, as a fulcrum to reach the world, if we reach the campus today, we reach the world tomorrow. And so we have been serving there for 18 years at this point, and it's been an incredible journey. I remember shortly after leaving my engineering job, coming to this church and inviting you all to help partner with us, and you did, and you have, in so many ways. If I gave you an overview of what I think, because part of when you're on the college campus, well, the culture that is currently on the college campus will be what you see in the rest of the world in 5-10 years. So we're kind of like, I see the first break of what's coming. And so it's part of my job to be very educated on what are the cultural beliefs and where are students currently so that I might speak into those things in a biblical way and help prepare them and equip them so that when they start families and businesses and are a part of their communities, that they are living out the right things, knowing truth and walking with Jesus in a way that's transferred into those parts of their lives. I think that if you were to nail down this generation, I would say this generation is one that has lived out of excess. An author, Tim Elmore, says that this generation is the OD generation. Not just because we see overdosing on fentanyl and other types of drugs and issues, but we see people overdosing on everything. If a little bit is good, then a lot must be great. They're overcommitted. They're overworked. They're overstressed. The anxiety, the depression, the mental illness, the things that are overwhelming students is incredible, debilitating. They've spent their time on their social media sites and on the virtual things and pornography and all of the things that have completely consumed them. They thought they were consuming, but it has consumed them. And so now, hopefully though, I believe there's a change occurring. There's a change in the winds on the college campus because they're exhausted and they're desperate and they want something. And where they used to try to add spirituality as a marginal, an add-on to everything else in life, they're beginning to finally recognize largely that the soul is at the heart of being. And that without a spiritual relationship with God, whatever else they want, they're not going to be able to find it in a way that satisfies them. The only thing more disappointing than not getting what you want is getting everything that you want and realizing it doesn't satisfy you. And that's this generation. And so it is an incredible, humbling honor to be able to speak Christ's truth into this generation in that way. I like to say this generation is experiencing the ego hangover, where their life has been all about them for so long. One of the tools that we use when we do evangelism, initiating evangelism on campus, is a deck of cards we call the perspective cards. And if you want to see these or know more about these, I can talk with you afterward. But we basically will sit down with a student in the student union or wherever students are hanging out. And I'll say, hey, do you have a few minutes to kind of give me your perspective on life? So it's just a deck of cards. But within this deck, there are basically five different points of a person's philosophy of life. What is the nature of God? What is the nature of humanity? Who was Jesus? Where do you find your source of spiritual truth? And then this one is what is the meaning and purpose of life? And so basically we'll pull this out and ask them like, well, we walk through each one of these and they pick the cards that best represent their beliefs. And so of all these different meaning and purpose of life options, to live for your descendants, there is none, love and peace, to live for God, to live for self, or to live for others. Which of these cards do you think most often students pick? 80 to 90% of students I talk with regularly, randomly, would pick this card. Which of these things do they say is the meaning and purpose of life ultimately? To live for self. Hands down. Hands down. And so part of my job and what's so complicated about it is to convince people that they need something beyond themselves. But thankfully, Jesus does this much better than I could in pointing him to himself. And so I just bring the message to a disoriented and desperate student life. So I believe there is an awakening happening. I don't know if you guys saw in the news. It's been over the last few months. There's been an organization called Unite Us, which was a sort of a big gathering of a Christian event. They came to Morgantown. They had been at Ohio State and Auburn and a few different places and making a lot of claims about 10, 15,000 people coming, thousands of students giving their life to Christ or at least resurrendering their life to Christ. They were just in Morgantown. There were about 5,000 in the basketball coliseum. And so I think this is somewhat indicative of what's true. I do believe there is an awakening on the college campus. A lot of people are saying it's a revival. I think that a revival, you can only tell if it's a revival 20 years out. Because a revival is something where the culture has changed, where people's lives are steadily changed, not just momentarily given to an experience. And so we'll see. We'll see if it's a revival. But there is definitely an awakening happening. And we've seen this throughout our organization. Our students, this is our prayer meeting. 43 students at our prayer meeting praying. That's not what college students do. I don't know how long it's been since you've been on a college campus. This is not how they typically spend their time. But these students are. We're seeing students desperately not just wanting to experience a faith that's real for themselves, but to desperately see the world transformed by the gospel in their peers, in their professors, in the people around them in the city. And so it's incredible. Here's a part of our leadership team right now. In the last 3 years, we've gone from about 11 student leaders to over 40 student leaders now. Students who are leading Bible studies We have 9 Bible studies across the campus in dorms, reaching freshmen, grad students, off-campus students. We're training them and equipping them to lead these Bible studies and invite people in so that they can reach their peers. They're taking the initiative and they're owning their own faith and they're changing the city and the campus. We're sending students. They're not just looking at what we can do for ourselves in a ministry. They're reaching the world. I took a group of 11 to Colombia, where we have a long-term partnership now. We've been going to Armenia. If you didn't know, my family and I moved to Bogota, Colombia, about 4.5 years ago. It was 5 years ago, I guess. Whatever, my wife will correct me on the specifics. 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. And out of that, we've developed a partnership in Armenia, Colombia. And so there's a university there, the University of Quindío. And the first time we went, we had about 10 students who were loosely involved. They're up to about 40 students who are consistently coming to the crew meetings on the campus there. And so this is, we had an English club. We presented an English club opportunity for them to come and learn how to speak English with gringos. And we expected about 20. We had about 120 show up. The language department, because last year when we went, one of the guys I discipled, Connor, met a guy named Juan David. I call him JD. It's easier. And JD became a believer and is involved in crew. And when he heard we were coming back and that we were doing an English club, he's a part of the English program. He went to his professors and said, whoa, 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 there's all these gringos. You should send the entire classes to this place. So JD, Juan David, brought the entire English language or international language department to us. And we were able to have spiritual conversations with literally in 10, 12 groups of 10 with all these students. And then meet with them throughout the week as things went on. So anyways, I could share tons and tons more about all this stuff. I'm just barely touching the surface on this. We are experiencing, maybe I'm at the end. Is that the last one I have maybe? Yeah. I'm going to skip back real fast to the beginning of the slideshow. Don't pay attention to the screen. We are experiencing a huge interest. Students are showing up to our weekly meetings and basically saying, hey, I just got the Bible for the first time, and I don't know how to read it. Is somebody able to meet with me and teach me how to do that? Sorry, I went way too far. There we go. I don't know how to work this. It was guitar strings and microphones, and now it's me. So it was perfect. There we go. But people are literally coming out of the woodwork. Our weekly meeting is growing. We're typically bringing 110 to 140 students weekly to come and be a part. We sent 40 to North Carolina on a mission over spring break. We're sending 16. Well, we have 16 students signed up to go on summer mission, where they give their whole summer to a mission to learn how to develop their own faith and reach the world. In discipleship right now, which is how we would say our key measurement for our success, is are we investing relationally in people in a way that they know Jesus and that they can help others know Jesus? And we have just breached over 100 students who are currently in one-on-one discipleship relationships on campus. It's by far the most we've ever had. And so we're seeing students replicating into students. And so we're not teaching people how to fish. We're teaching people how to teach people how to fish. And so, if you want, I could go on and on, but we wouldn't have time for the sermon. So I'm gonna transition, and if you wanna know any more about this, feel free, I'll hang around. I would love to talk your head off about all this stuff. Okay, one of the things we've been doing, we've been walking through the book of John with students. And so at 6:30 on Wednesday mornings, our leaders come together at Chick-fil-A. So we have 20, 30, maybe not usually 40, because a few don't make it at 6:30 in the morning. We walk through the book of John. If you can get college students out of bed at 6:30 in the morning, you can do anything. And so God is showing up in that way. And then on Thursday nights, I or one of their staff teach on a chapter of John. And then the students teach in their dorms a chapter of John. And so we've just finished it this past week, the whole book of John. But I wanted to jump back to one of my favorite passages, which is John 11. And I want to walk through that this morning. And I've entitled this The Lord's Incomprehensible Care, not because it's a big word I wanted to impress you with, but I just didn't know how else to say it. Because I think that when we think about God, and I think as students think about God, they have such a limited view of not just how powerful he is, but how much he loves them and how much he can transform their life if they have a relationship with him. And so I was, it's like it says in Philippians 4, that there is a peace that would guard our hearts, and it is incomprehensible. That there is something that we can't fully comprehend about how, not just how powerful and how in control and how sovereign and how glorious God is, but how caring he is. And I think most students don't really know God, not because they don't believe he could be true, but I think most students don't know God because they don't know that he loves them as much as he says he does. And so let me walk with you this morning. I'm going to pray as we start here. Father, thank you for this church family. Thank you for your word and the way that it not only speaks, has spoken into all of history, but it speaks into our own heart personally. Would you illuminate the message of resurrection this morning? And would it be fresh for us? And would it transform us, Lord? We love you. Amen. I'm going to give you just kind of a quick rundown of where we are in John as we jump into 11, just in case you haven't been here recently. In the book of John, Jesus spends, I would say, the first 10 chapters of the book basically showing the world that that the prophecies of his coming and the totality of who he is and God sending him makes him unique and in many ways not like us. In other words, I think he's proving his divinity. He's proving that he is unlike any other human in the existence of the world. In the first 10 chapters of John, he's doing all these miraculous things. The extraordinary, not the ordinary. And so in many ways, people are in awe. It's creating this spectacle. The crowds are rushing in. But it's in an extraordinary thing that they're following. And then I think as we get to this point in John, when the miracles have been fulfilled and when he begins saying things like, I'm the bread of life, I'm the living water, I'm the light of the world, I am the door, I am the good shepherd, I think we see Jesus transition to not just show that he is fully God, but to show that he's also fully human. And to relate to us in a way that's so deep and caring. And so, up to this point, this is sort of the image that Jesus has worked toward. And in verse 10, as he talks about being, in chapter 10, as he's talked about, I am the good shepherd and I am the gate, or I am the door. He's bringing an intimacy to his work. And he says this phrase, I know my own and my own know me. And there he's bringing this closeness of a shepherd with his sheep and an intimacy that he's about to, I think, really magnify in chapter 11 of John. And so as he walks into this situation, I'm going to read the entire chapter. Well, I'll stop before the last paragraph, but I'm going to read John 11 in its totality pretty much, just to give you perspective. So John 11, now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord. It's going to be hard to flip through this. Sorry, I didn't realize this would be tricky, but I can just read it from there. There we go. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with anointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake, I'm glad that I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off. And many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. But Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, even though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? They said, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews said, see how he loved him? But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? And then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by this time there'll be an odor, for he's been dead for 4 days. And Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they might believe that you sent me. And when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the man who had died came out, his hands and his feet bound with linen strips, his face wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. So I want to ask you a quick question. At Crew, students don't often interact very well. They've been on their phones too much or on social media too frequently. And so we usually have them turn to their neighbor. This never works as well at churches, though, I'll be honest. But I'm going to have you do it anyway this morning. I want you to turn to your neighbor and share with them a time when God answered a prayer that you prayed of him. So turn to your neighbor. I know it's awkward. It's okay. And tell them, when is a time God has answered a prayer that you prayed for him to answer? It could be anything. Maybe the parking spot this morning was close to the door. All right. I'm going to bring you back. How many of you shared a time when that answer from God was no? Kind of ironic, huh? Or even not now. We're so easily going to a space in our thinking where we're like, if it wasn't a yes, then it must not have been an answer. But that's because we want God to operate on our terms. But God's invitation is that we would begin to operate on His. And so as we see this play out in a really heavy and weighty emotional way with Mary and Martha and their brother Lazarus, I think that it stirs this tension in us that when we know who God is, or we think we know who God is, and we expect something of him, and then he answers in a way that we didn't expect, I think our default mode is to question the goodness of who God is and whether he's worthy of following. I think this is true for everyone. I remember a monumental moment in my life was I was a new believer, and I had just gone on a spring break trip with crew, and Christina came to me and informed me that her father had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer as a result of Agent Orange exposure, and that they thought he only had months to live. And I remember, like, I was rooming with a bunch of other guys, so the place was kind of a wreck. And I just remember laying down beside the bed, like, with my face to the ground, and thinking, like, I finally in my life know what kind of God I'm giving my life to, and I know what I can ask him, and I know that he would want him to be healed. And I know that he doesn't know Jesus, and I know that he had been absent from Christina's life since she was like 10 years old. And I think of all these things that we've been praying about, seeing restoration and life, and I thought I knew what kind of God I served. And so I prayed and I cried. I mean, I prayed longer than I had ever prayed before. Fast forward just not long after that, and I didn't have the answer that I thought. And it does something to your faith when you don't get the answer that you thought God would give you. And that's where we are in this passage with Mary and Martha. These were Jesus' friends, and they cried to him, "Come, Jesus, come and heal him." And then he had been dead for days before he gets there. But I think these are the three things that we see in this passage, is that Jesus comes in his perfect time, that Jesus cares passionately, and that Jesus calls the dead to life. Now, when Jesus comes in his perfect time, one of my friends says, we look at our watch, God looks at his calendar. God is orchestrating your life. He is also orchestrating eternity. This isn't just one view. God sees all things in all time and all to his glory. And so when we see in verse 4 and 5 that he loved them, then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake, I'm glad that I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. It creates this tension. How does he not go immediately when they're in need if he loves them? Depending on what you've experienced in your life, we've all had hardship, we've all had suffering, we've all had pain, we've all had disappointment. I think there's a greater thing at work, a Romans 8:28 kind of thing, where God works all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. But it's hard to see in the moment. A quote I know that Lance loves is by Helen Roosevelt. She says, God never uses a person greatly until he's wounded him deeply. The privilege he offers you in suffering is greater than the price you have to pay. The privilege is always greater than the price. He said, I didn't go because I'm going to do a greater work. Sorry, I'm jumping between slides here. It's complicated with this little clicker. Jesus says, they recognize that Lazarus has died, but I believe that Jesus is going to accomplish through pain. The way that this quote goes is, pain can set in our heart what pleasure cannot. That there's something that happens in the mourning and in loss that often brings us to an awareness or perspective that pleasure and comfort won't bring for us. And I would say at the ultimate end that death will bring a clarity that nothing else will bring. It brings a clarity to what is ultimate, what is final. When you think about people on their deathbed, they're not wondering what was meaningful in life. They have a great clarity. They may be wondering why they didn't spend their time on what was most meaningful. But in the moment that they come to a real reality that life is fleeting, I think there's a great clarity that happens. Mary and Martha were watching a dirt road coming up from Jericho. They had sent word to Jesus. Jesus, come. Where are you? Lord, if you had been here. In other words, what they're saying is, God, I needed you and you weren't there for me. And every one of us at some point in our life will experience that if you haven't already. And so the confusion that this brings is that we aren't sure that he cares. But what he shows us here is that Jesus cares. And not just that he cares in some distant and impersonal hope that Mary initially says is the reality. Yeah, of course, Jesus, in some distant way, yeah, I'm sure you'll work it out. It'll all be fine. There's a silver lining, sure. But instead, that he's saying, I am a hope for the present. And I am a hope that is definitive and eternal. So he doesn't just care, he cares passionately. You know, when my kids were crying when they were younger, they never cry anymore, but when they would cry when they were young, you know, what does a good father say? Hey, why are you crying? You know, when we inquire about someone's pain, when we're willing to listen and we want to understand where someone's pain is, it's the deepest level of human care. It's compassion. It's what Jesus was feeling in these moments. Jesus enters into their pain. And when it says that Jesus wept, if you are struggling with Bible verse memorization, this is a classic. This morning you learned a new one. But Jesus sobs. He's inconsolably sad at the pain that is happening. Because that's what happens when you care about something. I tell my staff team, sometimes we'll pause and people will have hard days and we'll talk about it and people will be crying and they're like, I'm sorry for crying. I'm like, don't apologize for crying. Tears means it matters. In fact, some of us need to cry more. I'm always leery of people who don't cry because I don't know if they care about anything. Like, what have you cared about in your life so much that it made you weep when you lost it or when you didn't have the outcome? Lance always tells me his eyes sweat all the time. I love that about Lance. Jesus wept. That's one of the, honestly, that you could probably meditate on that verse of the Bible for a year and still not get to the depth of how meaningful that is because it shows God's care for his people. There's an old phrase, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I think the same is true with God. People will not, and it's right because God's character is never separate from the truthfulness of who he is. Like he is who he is, but he's also got a personality. He's got emotion. He's got feeling in a sense that we can understand him and know him. And you shouldn't separate the two. And so I think a lot of times when I have conversations with students, they don't just want to think about what's true of God. They want to know, does God care? And oftentimes the only way that they know that is through his people. God is powerfully supreme over everything, but not at the loss of his care. He is in control and he is in care of you. Lord, if only you'd been there. I think many of us believe that God is loving, that he is good, but I don't know that we believe that God likes us. He's good. Is he good? Is he good for you? You could pray over someone else how much God must care about their circumstances. It's hardest for me to believe that truth for myself. And it probably is for you as well. Because we don't feel deserving of it. And the reality is we're not. But God is that good. We don't deserve it. And yet he gives it to us. He loves us in that way. Has anyone ever cried with you? I've sat with students. Sometimes I cry and they won't. Over their sin. But I've wept with students. It's a bonding thing. It is a deeply connecting experience. I think that of all the things I've experienced in my life, people crying over my pain might be some of the most meaningful. And so when pain comes and tears come, it creates a confusion about where God is. And that's what the world wants to know. Where is God? Where is God in my pain? And Jesus says here, a very complex truth that he's in it with us. There's a gentleman, Elie Wiesel, He was a Jew who was put in a concentration camp, wrote a book, and in his autobiography, he writes about a situation where the Jews would be ushered into the courtyard of the concentration camp, and just to create tension and fear in the Jews, they would randomly just hang people or shoot them. And so he said this one morning in particular, they brought three men, two older men and one younger boy, probably 13 years old, and they had the gallows set, and they put them on the gallows, and they kicked the boxes from under their feet, and the two men, older men on each side, both died instantly, and the young boy in the middle was squirming and suffering, and it went on and on, and he was kicking, not passing, and he writes in his autobiography, he hears from the back someone cry out, my God, where are you? And his answer was, I'm there in the gallows. That there is this tension that God is in our sufferings. And it doesn't mean that it makes it good. That's a horrendous, horrible thing. And in many of our lives, there are so many horrendous and horrible things. The beauty of the Christian faith is that unlike any other world religion, Christianity doesn't dismiss your pain or your sufferings. It doesn't call them good. It doesn't say that we should just embrace them or that it's due to us. The Christian faith says that pain and suffering is wrong and that God will right it, that the world is broken and that Christ will redeem it and that death and suffering will be restored. But our Jesus is in our sufferings with us. He understands the hurt, the pain, the complexities. He weeps with us in it. So Jesus, as he calls the dead, in John 5:25, Jesus said this phrase, the dead will hear my voice. The sin of man that brings death will be defeated. There's an idea that what Christ has been doing is he's not just teaching good things. He's not just teaching a moral way of living. He's not just writing a religious code. He's literally restoring the brokenness that entered into the world because of sin. And the consequence of sin is death. And so Jesus is making a proclamation that he has overcome the power of death and sin. And because of this, he's a resurrector. Jesus calls the dead for his glory, as we see in verse 4. He calls the dead to restore, to resurrect, to redeem, to give back what should have been. In verse 45, he says that he was the resurrection so that many would believe. There's a gentleman, Nabil Qureshi, was a Muslim who became a believer. And then shortly after, he passed away from stomach cancer. He had a huge impact on my life because I actually became a Christian in some weird turn of events through a Muslim man challenging me to read about Jesus in the Quran. And that's how my faith started. That's a very twisted story. I can tell you about that in a different time. But he was really impactful for me. And so I was praying along with his wife, Michelle. Now, I remember her story. As they were praying that he would be healed. And she says in an interview, that she prayed that he would be healed, but she knew that if he wasn't, that there'd be a greater good. And she said that she believed that he could be healed. And so when the diagnosis kept getting worse and worse, she still believed that he could be healed. And then she said she admitted, and she said, I don't know whether to be embarrassed this or not, but that when Nabil died, I went to his funeral and I prayed that God might resurrect him. And she's like, I don't know if that's foolish or not. She's like, part of me felt like that was so right, but also part of me felt like it was so unbelievable to say that. But the reality is that Jesus answers that longing. And that I love what she said is that even if he was sick and died, that God was still going to work a greater thing for his glory, and that she was okay in that. I think as we see Jesus loving and being compassionate and being the resurrection, Jesus loves with truth. In this portion, it says that as Martha and Mary were both experiencing them differently, when Martha runs to him, you almost see him correcting her She's like, yeah, yeah, I know these things. Yeah, yeah, I know these things. And he's like, no, no, I don't think you do understand these things. Like, I am the resurrection. Not like there will be a resurrection. And then you switch over to Mary later, and she says the same thing. If you would have been here, Lord, he wouldn't have died. And then what does he do for her? He weeps. Because I think that he comes both in truth and in tears. And God will tell you what you need to hear. He doesn't always answer through our pain, everyone in the same way. And so I think he both sometimes shares something that can be hard to hear from him. But other times, it could awaken something. And other times, he may just sit with you and mourn with you. Because I think we need both those things. We need truth, and we need tears in our lives. And God offers both of these things. And I think there's this shocking response for us is when Jesus speaks of death. Lazarus has died, and for your sake, I'm glad that I was not there. He's glad, but then he's mad. I think for a lot of the world, this makes sense. This is how they view God. Yeah, like he's like God sitting in heaven, and as tragedy happens in my life, he's like, well, you know, like I'm God. Disconnected, uncaring, uncompassionate. Or maybe even for a lot of us, we feel like, well, I probably deserve it. I mean, as we're all broken, I mean, what do we deserve? And so it's hard for us to wrap our minds around a God that would love us that unconditionally and would offer this kind of care and compassion and love. And so I think that it's shocking that Jesus waits and says he's glad. How do we make sense of that? How do you make sense of that? He was glad because he was going to do a bigger thing, because he was going to do a greater thing for his greater glory and so that others would believe, because he was going to do a final, an ultimate thing. And that no matter how long you could stave off someone who has sickness and you pray that they be well, death is still coming for every one of us. And the hope we have isn't that we defeat illness this side of heaven. It's that we defeat death eternally through the person of Jesus Christ. He is the resurrection and the life. And so that is our hope. It is not a temporary hope that Jesus is offering them, but he is offering them tears in the midst of their temporary situation. So I was thinking about whether I should share this or not. I don't want to put you on the spot, Lance, but I think that when we think about holding in tension God's work when it doesn't align with us, we put into question his character, whether we can trust him, whether he's good, whether he really loves us. And so I remember as a lot younger Christian meeting with Lance, you know, every now and then, and as he was walking with Bobby through her illness and ultimately losing her. I tell people this frequently because it's really impacted my life, that he would sit across from me at a gas station restaurant and he'd tell me about the difficulty of what it was like in that moment. Like, these things are so hard, Corey, and this has been so difficult. He'd be crying, and I wasn't a crier. I didn't know how to cry, I'll be honest. Lance taught me how to cry. Appreciate that, Lance. It's a weird gift to give somebody, but I do appreciate that. And he'd just be crying. He'd be like, man, this is so difficult. But he'd say, but Corey, God is so good. He's so good, Corey. He's so good. And that's it. You can gather that God can still be so good because we're going to have pain. But he says, take heart, right? His peace he gives to us. He has overcome the world. That we can have a joy and we can somehow have a joy and even in our deepest sorrows. And when we walk with Christ and when he walks through it, these things with us, that is what he can give us. And so he wasn't glad at death. In fact, he was bitterly angry. Then Jesus, the anger again welling up within him, so mad at all the things that are distorted and broken and rotten and wrong with the world and with us. So mad. Not like a little bit upset, so mad. Absolute despising hatred for what is wrong and broken. And he says, remove the stone. I will bring back to life what is dead. That's the story of Jesus. People have accused the Christian faith of being a crutch. I love what one author says, Christianity is not a crutch, it's a stretcher for the dead. If you're limping along hoping that you can do it in your power and your strength and that God might help a poor sucker like you, then you've got Christianity all wrong. Christianity is about the resurrection of your broken and lost soul. That only Jesus and by faith in him that he can restore. And that faith in him will bring the regeneration of what was always meant to be. That what was meant to be will be brought into fullness. It's an undoing. It's a reversing of all that sin did in the world. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? That's always been Jesus' invitation. Belief. Belief in what he's done. Not in what you can do for him. What he could do for you. As Jesus does this, as he makes this statement, and as he does all of this, what does it bring to him? It says from that point on, they made plans to put him to death. You know, it's interesting, the irony, even as we come up on Easter, is that he gave his life to save Lazarus. This is the first resurrection that happened as he was willing to lay down his life for Lazarus' sake. After this miracle, they sought to put him to death. But that there'll be another stone that's rolled away, and there'll be other souls called out of the grave when Jesus rises shortly after this, as you guys will find in the coming weeks, as those messages throughout Easter resonate hopefully more deeply with you. It wasn't just a resurrection for Lazarus' time. This is a resurrection for our time. This isn't just truth and tears for them. This was truth and tears for us. This wasn't just care and concern and compassion and a resurrecting of this life of Lazarus. This is our story. This is the opportunity. This is the offer that Jesus makes for us. And to live in that, if you know that, to live it out and to live in such a deep appreciation for what he's done on your behalf. So I think that as you think about Lazarus, my hope is that you shift from, in the same way I think that the viewers of the miracle of Lazarus shifted from saying, if only Lord, to Lord, you have. Lord, you have. You have risen, even on my behalf. So to wrap back around to Christina's dad, he did pass away shortly after that. He had the privilege of walking her down the aisle, and he was in and out of consciousness toward the end of his life, I think bitter toward God. Pastors were going to visit him. Largely, no one was able to even have a conversation with him until just a couple of days before he passed. He suddenly woke and had such clarity, incredible clarity. And a pastor went, and he shared the gospel with him. And her dad made a profession of faith and surrender his life to Christ, finally at that point in his life. And that's an ultimate thing. So it didn't end the way I wanted it to end, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that the restoration of what she would have wanted from him in her childhood, of even knowing him as he should have been, and him knowing me as I should be. Like, that's the promise. That's the eternal life that we're invited into. I love what George Herbert wrote. He said, death used to be an executioner, but the gospel has made him just a gardener. Jesus is restoring all the things that were broken. Not because he's just defeating death. When Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life, he's not just saying, I am the way to avoid death. He said, I am the way to experience God. That is the most satisfying. That is the longing of our soul. So I don't know that I don't think that Jesus ever intends this to be enough to just hear this and to be in awe of what happened. As many people would come to church on Easter and be amazed at what Jesus did, but for what reason? Because he made an offer to us. to believe in what he had done on our behalf, to bear the sins that we should pay for, to save us from death, the death that we deserve, and to offer us eternal life through our faith in him and faith alone. And so that is the offer that he makes. Let me pray for you and for me. Father, thank you for your word and for John's account of the resurrection, for the beauty of this story, but not just because it's true, but because it's an offer to each of us to rest in the power of you, Jesus, as the resurrection and the life. Lord, I pray that our lives would be reshaped, that the parts of our life that need to be remade, that that is your promise, not just to see us and to have concern, but to come alongside us and to change us. Thank you for the intimacy that you give to us. I pray that we would know your care and know your love, as undeserved as we feel it is. Lord, we know that that makes it that much more special. Lord, would we have a heart of Lazarus, even as he was restored to life. The ministry that he had historically because of this was outstanding. And so I pray that we would live in the same way. Lord, we pray all this in your precious name. Amen.